think that has now occurred, so you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court and opposing counsel, my name is Sarah Newell. I'm the attorney for the Nebraska Commission on Public Advocacy. I represent the appellant in this case, Larry Martinez. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Martinez admits that the trial court erred primarily in finding him competent and in overruling his motion to suppress the statements under Nebraska by statute 20-152. Because competency is always a foremost issue under the Constitution, I will start there. The standard of review in this case is laid out in State v. Johnson and as far back as State v. Watney, as well as State v. Fox, which is essentially if there is sufficient evidence in the record to support factual findings relating to competency, such factual findings will not be disturbed on appeal. This is a somewhat complicated standard to apply in the sense that it's not clear if this is a sufficiency of the evidence standard like we apply in a basic jury trial type setting, or if this is an abuse of discretion standard. When you go back and look at Johnson, which is a Court of Appeals case from a few years back, it complicates this matter even more because in Johnson we are looking at, or the court goes through this this description of both substantive due process and procedural due process rights. And this is important because what happened in Johnson was that a defendant did not necessarily initially think that he was incompetent. His attorney proceeded on the theory that the person was not, but the issue was raised kind of as a safeguard by his counsel saying, he doesn't think he's incompetent, I don't think he's incompetent, but I have this doctor who's raising these questions. And so the court went through a kind of quick and dirty analysis, asked him a few questions, and decided he wasn't competent, and moved on, or was competent, and moved forward with, taking the plea. What the court in Johnson said was, when you actually look, well, that the court by itself, the district court, can't just do its own analysis. You have to look a little bit more searchingly. There has to be a procedural due process requirement for actually looking at someone's competence. And that is, I think, the problem here, because although the court did go through a lengthy process of evaluating Mr. Martinez's competence, he relied on factors that are inappropriate. Specifically, he relied very heavily on layperson testimony, both in determining Mr. Martinez's competency and in determining and assessing 20-152, which I'll come back to. We submit that Mr. Martinez is not competent.
Isn't there expert testimony in the record that he was competent?
There were three different experts that testified. One testified for the state. His name is Dr. Carl Greiner. He is a psychiatrist. He is technically forensic certified. He has only done 4 competency evaluations in the entirety of his career. He opined that Mr. Martinez was competent. He relied on his own opinion, informed significantly by lay testimony, that Mr. Martinez was malingering. His explanation for why Mr. Martinez was malingering is because when he asked him basic questions, Mr. Martinez did not give answers that he found satisfactory or that he felt were contradicted by the lay testimony. He did not do any follow-up questions, as did the other, two.
And going back to our standard of review, what is that?
It is whether there is sufficient evidence in the record to support factual findings relating to the competency. I would submit that his findings are not sufficient to support. They're not sufficient factual findings.
Counsel, wouldn't it be for the trial judge to weigh the factual and then make findings from those facts, though?
He certainly did, and
wouldn't he further be then allowed to factor in lay witnesses? You don't always have to have solely expert testimony, do you?
No, you don't have to have solely expert testimony, but there is a reason why we have rulings regarding Daubert, Schaeferman, and 702 and distinctions between lay testimony and expert testimony, because there are certain things, particularly intelligence quotients and intellectual functioning, along with things like audiology and hearing abilities, that are particularly within the province of the scientific community. And that's part of why, especially in Johnson, the court said that it's not enough for the judge to just kind of squint and eyeball it. You have to have something more searching, and that there's a reason why we specifically have psychologists and psychiatrists and statutes that allow us to consult those folks.
In this matter, what's your position then? Experts are needed for the purpose of determining what?
Determining competency, particularly intelligence quotients. The issue of Mr. Martinez is not one of them.
But competency is sort of the outcome, determining what? Ability to understand, ability to hear, ability to process, which aspects...
All of those things.
...that are features of competency...
All of those things.
You, ...for which you need an expert.
I apologize, we're going to...
Yeah.
The standard for competency is whether the person has the capacity to understand the nature and object of the proceedings against him or her. That relates directly to Mr. Martinez's IQ, his general functioning. He has a 57 IQ, which is in that... To put that in context, 2% of the population are more intellectually deficient than him. 98% of the population is smarter than him. One of the things that Dr. Hunter described, and I think that her testimony is the most valid with regard to these particular issues because she is schooled in providing intelligence quotient testing. Dr. Greiner is not. He knows nothing about it. He's not qualified to either administer it or critique it, which is part of, I suspect, why the state didn't seek their own testing, although they certainly were free to do so. And she explained that not, and that the IQ testing demonstrates just a general intellectual functioning, but also the particular issue with Mr. Martinez is his concrete thinking and his slow like processing time. One of the things that she said about why he is not restorable, not likely to be restorable, is that even if you were to educate him about the roles of the court, which obviously he didn't understand, even the trial judge acknowledged that Mr. Martinez has at very least, or at the most, a very rudimentary understanding of the adversarial process. Even if you were to educate him about those issues, there's a question about whether his brain can process things fast enough for him to even effectively assist counsel.
So you're arguing that he's too mentally incompetent to prosecute?
Yes.
Are you also arguing he didn't know right from wrong?
No. That is not an issue that was raised at the trial level. Because we did not acknowledge his mental deficiencies until after we got into trial.
So what evidence do you have that supports your arguments or your defense that this occurred upon a sudden quarrel?
The evidence that we have that it occurred upon a sudden quarrel involves mainly the text messages between Mr. Martinez and Chris Kirchman, particularly the text message that he misconstrued as saying, I need a man and not a bitch. It's a quote from the record. What she actually texted something was something to the effect of, I need a man to take care of me and not bitch about money. But he and his intellectual functioning and also probably his reading issues because of his
auditory problem. So when they were texting this, they were not in close proximity to each other?
That is where it began. I would submit to you that if you listen very, very closely to what Mr. Martinez is saying in his interview, that he is telling the officers that he actually went to the house that she was at and had an argument with her, and she continued to, I think he uses the words, or it sounds to me like he uses the words, lit into him, arguing with him more, and that is when he lost it and shot her. So
doesn't he bring a gun to that argument, though?
He does.
So he has the text message communication. That gets him irate. He grabs his gun, drives to her location where he knows she's at, and then continues the argument. Is that correct?
I would submit to you that the evidence is not clear about whether he brought the gun, whether he had it with him on him, or whether he had it in the car. He certainly had it and took it with him to her location.
He carried it in the house.
Yes. And he might have had it on him the whole time. I mean, with all due respect, this is Sydney, Nebraska, and guns are commonplace.
Was there evidence in the record that he told someone before he went over to the house that he was going to kill her?
There was evidence that there was a discussion had between him and a roommate sometime prior where they'd had an argument and he made a comment that the roommate took as a joke or as kind of one of those things that you say when you're frustrated, which was, I'm going to kill that bitch. It was not something that was said immediately prior to, and again, it was not linked as something that was related to the actual murder until after the murder occurred.
But you are arguing or conceding that there was a text message to the defendant that made him mad.
Yes, there were a series of text messages over the course of their entire relationship.
He had the intelligence enough to know that what was said to him was not flattering and not something that he thought was complimentary.
True. And I guess what I would say with regard to the issue of intelligence is that even a dog knows when it's being degraded or when it's being kicked. It doesn't necessarily indicate higher level functioning. I guess to provide more context to this idea of what concrete thinking is, one of the reasons, I guess, an example that we have used and that Dr. Hunter used in explaining this to me was There's a gentleman that was executed who was mentally retarded under the classical DSM-IV diagnosis in Arkansas, who, upon eating his last meal, asked for pecan pie but didn't finish it. And they said, well, hey, buddy, do you want to finish your pie before we walk down the hall? And he says, no, I'll come back and get it later. That is an example of concrete thinking. That gentleman was obviously went through the process of knowing he was to be executed, knew that this was his last meal, and knew that he was going to be walking down that hallway to be executed. He might be able to use the term executed, and he might be able to understand that he is being executed for bad things that he has done, but he doesn't understand enough about that process to realize that he is not going to be able to come back and eat his pie. And that is what Mr. Martinez's functioning is like.
So
Mr. Martinez
say that,
doesn't understand he's not going to get to come back.
So you would say that after he shot her, he would probably call her up tomorrow for a date.
And that's exactly what essentially happened. There's evidence in the record that he was talking to the officers and thought that she had texted him later in time after she'd been shot and was killed. So he thought that they were just going to talk it out and it would be fine.
And there was just one shot fired.
That's my understanding. With regard to this, I mean, the issue of concrete thinking is obviously the most profound problem, but also the auditory processing. The question of whether or not he remembers enough about the circumstances to be able to assist counsel, and whether he can comprehend his or her condition in reference to the proceedings. That understanding of whether he's going to be able to come back and eat the pie. Examples that are clear from the record are, when asked, what does your lawyer need from you? He answered, not go back to Sydney. When she's asking, what does she need from you? She's asking about to help me help him in terms of his defense. And he says, not go back to Sydney. Obviously, he has no control over that. And these questions, mind you, have been asked after the trial has already occurred. So this is the most poignant example of the fact that he is not educable. He is not someone that can understand, because he's gone through this process. He doesn't learn auditorily. His verbal IQ is way lower than his performance IQ. So the best way to teach someone like him is their performance IQ. He's gone through the trial. We tried to educate him over and over and over again. He's seen it, and he still doesn't understand. Particularly...
Counsel, yes. Did you help try the case?
I tried the case.
Okay. So you worked with him through the trial process?
I did indeed.
But yet, you worked with him through the whole trial process, but it wasn't until after the trial that you filed a motion to determine competency. Is that correct?
This is correct.
Okay, so through that process, being alert to those type of issues, being an experienced attorney, if you had serious concerns during the trial, you'd have filed the motion during the trial, wouldn't you?
I will tell you that I had serious concerns throughout, but it was unclear to me how much of it was auditory and how much of it was mental incapacity. I would also indicate that, unfortunately, as a criminal defense attorney, you represent people all the time that don't seem to track and don't seem to understand, and a lot of times those people come back as competent or come back with, you know, IQs in the 70s, 80s, 90s. So I am not in a position, as is a psychiatrist or, well, really a psychologist who's going to be doing IQ testing, to gauge someone's intellectual functioning. The other thing I would say about Mr. Martinez...
But you didn't offer any evidence of his intellectual functioning at trial?
No, because we didn't see it as an issue. I did not see it as an issue, and that is something that he absolutely should raise as ineffective assistance of counsel, post-conviction. If he is, as deceptively malingering as the state says, he can write his own pro se brief, I suppose. The difficulty is that people like Mr. Martinez have spent their entire lives with these auditory functioning issues. He's deaf in certain frequencies. He's severely hearing impaired in others. He's profoundly
What's the chance that this won't happen again? If he doesn't understand the system, doesn't understand that shooting someone in the heart is permanent, what do you do with a person like that?
I think that
you say you can't prosecute him because he's not smart enough to know what's going on?
There are two different things that can be done. I think he can either go to the regional center to try to educate him, which is what Dr. Moore had talked about at the hearing, or there's also a series of statutes that allow someone to be civilly committed as a developmentally disabled person. And I omitted that language from this particular brief. I included it in the brief in the trial court. But I think that there is another procedure for people like Mr. Martinez to be handled.
How did the trial court err in view of the procedural posture that was presented to it?
I think that the court erred by relying too heavily on lay witness testimony and Dr. Greiner's testimony, which was not supported by the evidence, particularly in emphasizing, and even Dr. Greiner acknowledged the points that I've made with regard to certain letters that Mr. Martinez wrote that show he still doesn't understand well after the process. He acknowledged that those things are concerns, but had no explanation for why he ignored them completely. Instead, Dr. Greiner emphasized factors that relate to his adaptive functioning, like whether he's been able to get a driver's license, whether he's been able to get married, whether he's been able to hold a job. Those things relate to disability requirements in terms of your adaptive functioning, but that's a whole separate issue than whether you understand the process enough to be able to go through it. The difficulty and the reason why we have these standards is because if people don't understand what's happening, then it's fundamentally unfair for them to be prosecuted and to be punished in this way because they just simply don't get it.
And in view of the record and the posture, how did the trial court err?
The trial court erred by ignoring the obvious evidence and finding that there was sufficient evidence when there was not sufficient evidence to say
what,
that he was competent.
What ruling?
His just the order that he provided in saying that Mr. Martinez was competent and in his litany of explanations for relying on Dr. Greiner's analysis.
Counsel, he didn't have to rely upon your experts, right? He could discount them.
He certainly can.
Even if your experts were the only evidence.
That's true. If there's sufficient evidence, he can rely on whatever he chooses to.
No, I'm just saying, if your experts were the only evidence, as a trier of fact, you don't have to accept that, do you?
No, that's absolutely true. However, the standard of review still requires sufficient evidence in the record to support the factual findings. And I submit to you that there's not sufficient evidence in the record to support the factual findings. Because if we just acknowledge or if we just take what the trial court says as gospel any time that there's an expert and say, well, we're not going to even engage in any review, then why do we have a standard of review? There has to be some meaning to this phrase or else there's no point. And I submit to you, like I said, that there's just simply not enough evidence to justify a finding of competence in this case if you actually look at the record. I will move on, before I get too far into my time, to the second issue of Nebraska Revised Statute 20-152. In addition to Mr. Martinez's profound intellectual deficiencies, he also has very significant hearing deficits. One of the things that, I guess because of that, I filed a motion to suppress under 20-152, which is a very unique statute that deals with and provides specific rights of protection to those who are deaf and hard of hearing. One of the things that the state says in its brief repeatedly and that the court kind of did was that they misread the standard and they try to craft onto this very clear statute language about whether or not Mr. Martinez understood enough. The difficulty that we have is Mr. Martinez is very good at passing. He has lived his entire life with this low IQ. He's lived his entire life with these hearing deficits. He doesn't know how much he doesn't know, but he does know that he doesn't like to feel like an idiot. And so he tries very hard and has learned over time to answer questions in ways that make people happy with him and that deter further discussion. And because of the language of the statute, specifically 20-152 and the definition of hard of hearing, I submit to you that the court is not at liberty to go to other states to interpret that language, and the language is plain and unambiguous. I'm just going to do this, go through this really briefly, and then I will sit down so I actually have some time for rebuttal. The standard that is looked at in 20-152 is whether a statement is made by a deaf and hard of hearing person to law enforcement. If that is the case, then if it is not made through a licensed interpreter, then it must be thrown out. The only exception is that if it is not made through an interpreter, that can be waived if it's done knowingly, intelligently, voluntarily, and in writing. That was not done here.
How is the person under that definition to manifest that condition to law enforcement?
That is not laid out in the statute. I understand the trial court's wanting to read into that statute a requirement that the defendant communicate their disability. However, if you look at these statutes, there's nothing in these statutes that says that this is triggered only if the defendant indicates that this is necessary. I would submit to you that Mr. Martinez has a very clear lisp and very clear auditory. I mean, all of his doctors noticed and acknowledged it as being indicative of his hearing impairment. That was one of the things that clued me into the idea that he had hearing impairment issues, same with prior counsel. The officers in this case just refer to it as an accent. I think that is a misstatement, or at least I think is an unfair characterization. I think that they knew enough to know that there should have been some questions asked.
Well, what evidence in the record do you use to draw that conclusion?
The record is replete with prior doctors and also Dr. Ray, and I think even Dr. Garner acknowledged.
No, I'm talking about known to the law enforcement officers.
There's nothing that indicates that it was known to them, aside from the fact that they noticed his accent. As I said before, I don't think that the statutes actually require anything of the sort. The statutes, as I read them, kind of put the onus on the state and say the state must provide an interpreter.
So the state must discover that there's a hard of hearing person first. And how are they to go about doing that? Or are we reading this statute to enable a deaf or hard of hearing person to just, as they used to say in my neck of the woods, to lay in the weeds until later?
I would submit to you that the language of the statute does not put the onus on the defendant. It's not very clear on this issue. There's, I have a provision if I may. One moment, I see that I'm into. I think the overarching policy is that the policy of the state of Nebraska is to secure the rights of deaf and hard of hearing persons who cannot readily understand or communicate in spoken language and who cannot equally participate in or benefit from proceedings. The way that they define deaf or hard of hearing is not necessarily based on something that requires the state to necessarily know it. I think it's quite possible, as with Mr. Martinez, that you may not be aware of it. But I don't see anything in here saying that the language of 20-152 is only triggered if law enforcement knows.
If they don't know, how do they provide for an interpreter?
I can acknowledge that that would be a difficult thing to do, but I don't think that that changes the application of 20-152.
Counsel, before you sit down, how would an interpreter have assisted Mr. Martinez? Is there anything in our record that indicates that an interpreter would have assisted him in any respect?
That is also a complicated issue. There is evidence in the record through Dr. Ray that he had used an interpreter, a sign language interpreter, in the past. What I think is important about 20-151, the definition, is that the first prong talks about may have difficulty in auditorily processing spoken language without the use of an interpreter. But the second part also includes or other auxiliary aid. And auxiliary aids are clearly defined as including things like sign language interpreters, oral interpreters, but also note takers, transcription services, written materials, assisted living listening devices like hearing aids, assisted listening services or systems, video text displays, and other visual delivery systems.
That defines difficulty. It doesn't define the duty to provide the interpreter is all that this statute affords. Isn't that correct?
This statute says that if an interpreter is not provided or waived in writing, that statement shall not be used. What I would submit to you is that in circumstances like Mr. Martinez's, what should happen is that they should communicate with him in writing and see if he can waive his rights knowingly, voluntarily, intelligently in that regard.
But are you saying
separate and independent of the intellectual function?
At what point?
I want to go on forever. Are you saying he can read?
He certainly has written letters back and forth. He can read. The extent to which he understands those issues is different. One of the things that I think, one of the reasons kind of going back to competency of why you need to really look at Dr. Hunter's understanding and discussion of his intellectual functioning issues is because just because he can read at certain levels doesn't mean he understands the concepts that are necessary for this process. So I would acknowledge that 20-150 at SEC is not written in
at
the way
what,
that it's...
At what point do you think that the dictates of 20, I'll call it 152, were failed to be observed? At what point?
At the point that he was interviewed and did not waive his right to an interpreter in writing.
Thank you.
I see that I'm well over my time. Unless there are other questions, I'll move on.
Thank you very much. Ms. Tangeman, good morning to you.
May it please the Court, I'm Erin Tangeman, Assistant Attorney General representing the State of Nebraska.
I will begin where Ms. Newell left off and address the first assignment of error, which is the claim that the district court erred in overruling his motion to suppress the statement made to law enforcement pursuant to Section 20-152. The state's position is that although Martinez does have a hearing impairment, the district court was correct in denying the suppression motion because Martinez is not deaf or hard of hearing as defined by the applicable statute. The protections of Section 20-152 are not triggered solely by a hearing impairment. Instead, the hearing impairment must be so severe that the use of an interpreter or another auxiliary aid is required in order for that person to process or understand the language being spoken. The best evidence in evaluating whether Martinez had that type of hearing impairment is the video recording of the law enforcement interview itself. Martinez, who was not wearing hearing aids at the time, had no difficulty answering questions or engaging with the officers. Throughout the 25-minute interview, he tracked the questions being asked and he responded appropriately to those questions. He didn't simply say yes or no. He provided detailed answers to each question throughout the interview. He would respond immediately when a question was asked, and although there were a couple of times where he answered with a huh or a pardon, this did not happen frequently, and he had no problem responding to the question after it was repeated. The officers would often repeat back the answer Martinez gave, and Martinez would confirm that that was in fact what he said. More than once, Martinez corrected the officers when they misstated what he had previously told them. Not only did Martinez respond to the questions from the officer who was sitting directly across from him, but he also responded to the questions asked by the officer who was sitting off to the side in the room. Martinez would immediately turn to that officer when a question was asked, and he would respond to the question. Martinez also responded to officers while his back was turned to them. This happened when handcuffs were being put on him or taken off of him. Martinez also followed all verbal commands given to him at the time of his arrest, a number of which were given when his back was turned to the officers. State believes that the overwhelming evidence demonstrates that despite his hearing impairment, Martinez does not fall within the definition of a deaf or hard of hearing person under the statute, and thus law enforcement had no duty to provide him an interpreter because he does not fall within the statute, as the officers obviously were not aware of any hearing issue.
On that sort of more hypothetical level, do officers have to know to trigger this statute?
I think that the definition of deaf or hard of hearing person basically sets forth the type of person that's going to fall within that definition. It's going to be obvious to an officer because they're not going to be able to communicate without sign language, without a hearing aid, without some type of aid to them. And so the officers will have knowledge if the statute is in fact triggered.
But doesn't the language that he or she may have difficulty insert some ambiguity, is not the right word, but some lesser standard? It says severe and then it says may have.
I think that,
how do you reconcile that?
I think that is to not put, I guess they didn't want to give an absolute that it has to be used in every circumstance, because I think sometimes hard of hearing people can't read lips. They might be able to understand from verbal cues, but I think I don't know if I have the best answer
but
to that
Ms.
question.
But as Ms. Newell has remarked, the defendant in this case and others perhaps have a habit of passing for having better ability than they do.
Yes.
So in view of that, going back to Justice Castle's question, what are we to say this statute requires of an officer?
I think if an officer is aware that there is a hearing issue, then the statute has to be followed. But I don't think a confession can be thrown out when you look at the entire interview and he was tracking, he was following, he was answering questions. There's absolutely nothing to indicate that he was having any hearing problems. I think, you know, the district court in its order talked about another provision in those statutes about how if the officer thinks the hearing impairment is being faked, basically, then they can require some know, type of additional evidence. So once again, that puts it back on, the officer has to know that there is some type of hearing impairment. And here we don't have that.
What is our review of what the district court did here? What is our standard of review?
I think, well, obviously there's some statutory interpretation, which is going to be a question of law. And then I think it'd probably go in line with general suppression, findings of fact, review of clear error, and any legal questions.
But this is a statutory right, not a constitutional right.
True.
And what difference does that make in the standard of review?
I guess I'm not sure. You know, this is an issue of first impression. Obviously, how this court interprets a statute is going to be a question of law. The factual findings of the district court, I think, will be clear error. I think it's beyond that.
Does the defendant claim it's a constitutional right?
No, I don't believe so. I believe she does have a separate...
An access to justice issue.
I believe the first assignment of error is limited to the statute only. There is a second assignment of error regarding the separation of powers, with those assignments of error pretty much linked. If one has merit, then two does, vice versa. Unless this court has additional questions on the suppression issue, I'll move to competency. The basis for the competency motion was Martinez's low IQ. This court has held that a defendant's lack of a mental ability is not sufficient to prove incompetence to stand trial, and that mental retardation does not necessarily imply incompetence to plead or stand trial. The defendant's own expert, Dr. Moore, testified that a low IQ doesn't necessarily mean incompetence. The evidence presented at the competency hearing supports the district court's finding that despite his IQ, he did have the capacity to understand the nature and the objects of the proceedings against him, to comprehend his own condition in reference to those proceedings, and to make a rational defense. The state's expert, Dr. Greiner, found that although he does have intellectual deficits, they are not so profound as to limit his ability to participate if he chose to do so. Dr. Greiner found that during the competency evaluation, Martinez was more capable in situations that he did not think were related to the competency issue, and that his lack of remembering was willful in that he could not recall information of situations that would be negative to him. Dr. Greiner believed that Martinez underperformed on the questions of his capacity compared to the information he had given elsewhere in the interview on the same day, and that Martinez saw it in his best interest to be incapable. Dr. Greiner's conclusion is supported by the testimony of Tina Parks. She is a corrections officer at D&E and spent a significant amount of time with the defendant. Her deposition was missing from the Bill of Exceptions at the time I filed my brief. The court reporter has since corrected that. And I just wanted to highlight a few things from her testimony since it's not included in my brief. Parks was with the defendant around the time he was getting these competency evaluations. And she saw none of the memory issues or the lack of understanding of the court process that Martinez presented to both Drs. Moore and Dr. Greiner. Defendant told her when it was his one-year anniversary of being in custody, he returned from trial and wanted his old job back, and he didn't have to be retrained. He didn't have any memory issues there. He also knew every time he came back from court. He knew that he had been in court. He also knew when court hearings were coming up, and he would consistently ask about when he was supposed to be transferred, and he would get upset if he thought he should have been heading back to Sydney for court. There are also a number of kites in the record where Martinez is constantly telling the clinic, I have a court hearing coming up, I need my hearing aid. I have a court hearing up, I need this. He was clearly aware that a court proceeding was going on, which is contrary to what he told Dr. Moore. Finally, Parks testified that when the defendant received a letter from his attorney advising him that he would be getting some type of competency hearing, or potentially even that the expert had found him incompetent, he brought that letter to Parks, said it was good news, he was laughing and smiling and excited, and he explained that if he's not competent, he wouldn't have to do his time in the prison system, that he would just have to do his time in the regional center. And when Parks asked, was that a good thing, he said, yes, it's a very good thing. clearly Martinez knew what was going on.
All of this is post-trial evidence.
What?
All of this competency is post-trial.
Yes, the competency motion was not filed until after the trial.
Can you do that?
Yes, I think you can do that. I think this is an... this court has held that if
you're... So you wait and decide whether or not you're convicted, and then if you're convicted, then you come in and file a competency motion after the trial?
Well, I don't think that... I think the fact that the defense waited until after trial to file a motion of competency that's based purely on IQ shows that he's competent. He had four attorneys from the commission over a two-year period, and they never once questioned his competency. It's not a situation where something happened mentally and he was competent at trial, but now he's not competent for sentencing. They're saying he's not competent, he's never been competent because of his IQ and because of his IQ only. Now, I don't know that a court can deny a competency hearing and say that it's waived because it wasn't raised, but I think the fact that it wasn't raised showed that he is competent. He's been competent all along, and Dr. Greiner's conclusion is supported by the evidence. There are a number of letters in the record that the district court referenced where Martinez speaks of being convicted, his attorney's reaction to the conviction. He was hoping that he would have been convicted of one of the lesser included offenses of either second degree or manslaughter, that his attorney is fighting hard for him, that he's expecting to go back to court, that he felt it wasn't fair that he was tried in Sydney because everybody knew him there and he wanted to move for a new trial and change of venue. He knows that he gets an appeal after his sentence and that they intend on appealing. He had stated in some letters that he was unfairly convicted, he didn't have anything to do with the murder, that he wasn't around when it happened, that he got blamed for it just because he was dating Mandy. And he also asked his nephew to help him out to obtain a picture that he believed would help with his case. The state believes that all this evidence is sufficient to support the district court's finding of competence. Unless this court has any questions on the competency issue or any other issue, we'll ask you to affirm the judgment of the district court.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal? There is no time for rebuttal. We will go on then.